And I want to start by asking the question, what can a poet do with science? What can a poet make of science? What kind of engagement encounter might you expect to find? And I want to start by sharing with you a poem by the contemporary American poet Patty Ann Rogers, who imagines such an encounter between the institutions and the people of science and a poet. This is her poem from her collection, The Expectancy of Light, in 1981. NASA takes a 63-year-old poet to the first space station. Finally ready, they come for him at dawn. Touching each elbow, they surround him carefully, like a porcelain vase. They have a car waiting. He needs no special suit, his gabardine pants, flannel shirt, khaki tie. They're pleased with his fingertips, the creases in his shoes. Into the gleaming shuttlecraft, they lead him to his room. All of his walls are wide, circular windows facing forward, his ceiling a skylight. He settles on pillows in his high-domed cubicle of glass. The rise is perfect, silent, without tremor. He's carried up through the early grey fog of the eastern seaboard, out over the earth, an enormous belly of blue. Far ahead, he sees the massive construct floating, the pristine exactness of its white metal, silver girders, wired columns of crosses, and mirrored wheels turning slowly. As he watches, sped forward into the cloudless and the snow-silent, into the blue-black hollow, into the dust-free, spit-and-polished starlight of the nethermost, they hand him his pencil and pad. What I like about this poem, I think it's a very funny poem, is the clichés involved in it, in a sense. What Patty Ann Rogers is doing is outlining how we might imagine an encounter between the world of science, very technologically advanced, very slick, gleaming, very mechanical, and the poet. The poet, of course, is this, in this case, 63-year-old man, a bit shabby, creases in his shoes. Doesn't say what they like about his fingertips, but we can imagine it might be slightly dusty, perhaps, or it might be the refinement of the fingertips. It's the physical body, and it's set against the machinery of the space age. He's also, in some sense, like a work of art, or they treat him like a work of art. They treat him like a porcelain vase. He's very fragile. He's very breakable, this poet. He's imagined to be very breakable. And then he has this experience of being taken off into the space age, into the space world. You have this sort of 2000 AD kind of vision, or 2001 rather, vision of the space station itself. And then you have that marvellous moment at the very end where they hand him the pencil and pad, as if the poet can be expected to produce, much as in the way the scientists imagine their own machinery produces. That's the moment of it. They say, okay, write your poem, write about this experience, write about this encounter with the scientific world and with what science shows us, this new vision of the Earth. So Patty Ann Rogers gives us, if you like, a kind of comical vision of what an imagined encounter might be between the scientists, NASA, the astronauts, and this cliched figure of the poet. What I want to do is move beyond that kind of cliché, move beyond that kind of juxtaposition, to think about what poets can do with the knowledge that science reveals. And I'm particularly going to look at the science of life. I'm going to look at biology because it's what I am most confident doing and know most about. And particularly I want to look at the way in which the technologies of science open the horizons of poets, the way in which poets respond to particular scientific discoveries, scientific ideas, with a kind of specificity. But also to think not only about this as a response, this is a kind of the poet writing back to science, but also a way in which poetry can open our minds to new perspectives on scientific thinking, scientific discoveries, the way in which poetry can enrich our experience and understanding of science. So what I'm going to do then for the rest of the talk is look at five poems, mostly by contemporary poets, though one of them is a little bit earlier, about aspects of biology. The first of these poems is Alive by Judith Wright. Judith Wright is, to my mind, one of the most impressive post-war poets writing in English. She was the leading voice within Australian poetry from about the 40s through to the 70s or so. She was also a massively influential campaigner on behalf of indigenous peoples, on behalf of environmental on behalf of the environment, let's say, on an ecological campaign. And she's an extremely profound thinker, I think. This is her poem Alive, then, and I point out that it's from a book called Alive. So even at the beginning of the poem, you have the title, as it were, twice reinforced for you. And this is where the microscopes come in. Light and water. One drop. Under the microscope, an outline. Slight as a rim of glass. Barely and sparely there. A scarcely occupied shape. What's more, the thing's alive. How do I recognise in a fleck so small no human term applies, no words so minimal, life's squirming throb and wave? Locked in the focused stare of the lens, my sight flinches, a tiny kick. The life in me replies, signalling back, "You there? I hear." What matters isn't size. What matters is form. Form concentrated, exact, proof of a theorem whose lines are lines of force, marking a limit. Trim, somehow matter of fact, even matter of course, but alive, like my eyes, alive. So having introduced the poem, in effect, with that word alive twice over, she returns to that word alive twice over at the end of the poem in the final line to reinforce what is essentially a moment of recognition. The technology of the microscope has enabled the poet, looking down the microscope, at what you would think of as a very, perhaps to return to another kind of cliched idea, potentially a very sterile scientific piece of apparatus, the slide with the water drop on it. And yet within that, she not only sees and detects the presence of life, but it sparks this moment of recognition. It sparks this "you there, I here" duality. And the way she writes about that, I think, is quite striking. I think, for example, that the presence of the wave is interesting here. It's a throb and wave, it's just a movement. But a wave, of course, also suggests some kind of mode of communication, almost some kind of reaching out from the speck. It's imagined there, it's not actually a wave like that, but that's one of the senses in which that word operates within our mind to create that kind of association. The tiny kick as well suggests something purposive. And I also think it's very striking that she pays attention so much closely to language here. There's no word that is minimal enough, small enough to talk about this minute speck of life. And yet, of course, that's what the poem does. And what the poem recognises as a sign of life is form, this bounded cell, if you like. But of course, the poem is itself putting language into form. Concentrated. Exact. So the poetry enables her to express the recognition and also to, in some sense, build form out of form. Build form out of that recognition of form in another living thing. So tiny, so minute. The second poem I want to look at is by Philip Appleman, who's a contemporary American poet. Appleman has written a lot about Darwin. He's an expert on Darwin, both as a scholar and as a poet. His probably his most well-known collection is called Darwin's Ark, from 1984, republished in a quarter-centenary edition for the Darwin Bicentenary in 2009. And this is one of the poems from that. And like so many of the poems in that book, it responds particularly to, in this instance, Darwin's science. Darwin's, in this particular case, expression of the emotions in man and animals. Darwin's way of thinking about other organisms and human beings too. This poem here, Waldorf Astoria Euphoria, The Joy of Big Cities, is one of a pair of poems called Euphorias. And the two together are headed with this quotation, the first quotation, from the expression of the emotions. "I heard a child, a little under 4 years old, when asked what was meant by being in good spirits, answer, 'It is laughing, talking, and kissing.'" Then each poem has its own epigraph, and this is the epigraph to Waldorf Astoria Euphoria. "Joy, when intense, leads to various purposeless movements, to dancing about, clapping the hands, stamping, etc. I should say before I read the poem that the Waldorf Astoria, in case you don't know, is an immense and very posh hotel in New York, which was famously kind of the haunt of debutantes and gangsters in the 30s and has remained a kind of elite institution. So this is a poem set in New York. You feel so good, you stop walking. They swirl around you, racing the 6:15. You bless them all with a smile you cannot explain. They are suddenly precious. You look around with your alien eyes at 40 floors of windows where they are laughing, talking and kissing. You realise they are priceless. You feel them under the pavement, riding the Uptown Express, strap-hanging bodies waving like kelp, and you know they are irreplaceable. You think of them all over town, bursting with unused happiness, and you clap and clap again, and clapping you sing a song you thought you'd forgotten, and your waist moves gently like jonquils, and your hand catches her fingertips, and she smiles, her arms moving like willows, and the fruit seller dances with apples, crying a musical language, and a girl with a bongo comes on with rhythm, her hips moving like wheat fields, and the hard hats coming up from the manholes, their bodies moving like jackhammers, and Chinese voices like wind chimes sing to the women from San Juan who gather around like palm trees. And the cops have cordoned the street and are dancing with women from Minnesota, their thighs as seductive as seaweed. And you know that sooner or later this had to happen, that somehow it would all break out, all that pent-up joy, and people would sing and hold hands, their bodies swerving like taxis, and the music inside their heads would fill the streets with dancing, clapping hands and stamping. And you sing another chorus of we, hey, we, yes, we, I said, we are all we've got. What I find so striking about this poem, apart from just the energy of it, the movement of it, the way it's long, long sentence that makes up most of the poem, captures and I was going to say distills, but distills is exactly, in a sense, wrong. Sweeps through with this movement of the purposeless movement, in fact, that Darwin identifies in the epigraph. But aside from that, what I think is so striking about it is its combination of a celebration of the worldview of Darwin and the worldview, in a sense, revealed by Darwin. This world which is full of joy, it's full of laughing, talking and kissing. So it's a celebratory poem in that sense, and yet at the same time, it's also a very stark poem. And that closing moment, that sort of real emphasis of solidarity, we, four, even five times, and yet it's all we've got. Appleman is not going to let us have anything beyond this life. And so he's giving us this choice in a way, through the poem. He's encouraging us, and of course he's addressing it to us. He says, you feel so good. So you're kind of, we're all folded into the experience of the poem. He's giving us this choice to endorse that worldview, join in with that celebration, and accept that we are all we've got. Or, if we can't accept that we are all we've got, the question is, in a sense, what happens to that invitation to join with that purposeless movement? Purposeless movements, I think, is really interesting here, because he's saying this is, in a sense, a purposeless universe that Appleman finds in Darwin's world, but it's a world which we can nevertheless give our own meaning to, find our own meaning within, in this highly celebratory way. And it's also, I think, very interesting the way he links the words that are attributed by Darwin to a four-year-old girl. A four-year-old girl is pretty well the epitome of a symbol of innocence, although, of course, being the father of a seven-year-old girl and a three-year-old girl, like I obviously know that's nonsense, but nevertheless, we still think of four-year-old children as kind of symbols of innocence. So that innocence is carried over to the celebration of what is a much more eroticized interpretation of kissing, particularly the dancing too, within the poem. That becomes a celebration of an erotic innocence as well. So Appleman looks to Darwin's science and he finds something to celebrate within it. In a way, so does Wright, looking down the microscope. You get this kind of sense of a kinship in both poems. The next poem I'm going to read you is a much darker poem, a much more worried poem, a much more concerned, doubtful poem. This is Grimoire by Michael Donoghue, who's an Irish-American poet who died a few years ago. And there's a very interesting story behind this poem, which is that it was a product of an experiment, really, that was orchestrated by the Scottish poet and academic Robert Crawford, who got some funding to bring together, in several individual encounters, poets and scientists. So the way this would work is that the poet would go to meet the scientist in their lab or their museum or their field trip, wherever it might be. The scientist would say something about what they were doing, show them some of their tools, explain some of their ideas. The poet would go away and write a poem, send it to the scientist, who would in turn write a response. And the poems and the response are published in the book Contemporary Poetry and Contemporary Science, edited by Robert Crawford, from which this is taken. Now, Donoghue was introduced to Kevin Warwick, who's a colleague of mine at Reading. Kevin is famously the author of I, Cyborg. He's the man who had a microchip implanted in his arm. And he pursues, he's a professor of cybernetics, and he pursues, if you like, post-humanism, post-human research, post-human possibilities of life hybridized, if you like, with computers. And Donoghue was both, I think, fascinated and rather disturbed by this, and you can see this from the poem. So the poem has an epigraph. An intervening object does not impede the vision of the blessed. Christ could see the face of his mother when she was prostrate on the ground, as if he were looking directly at her face. It is clear that the blessed could see the front of an object from the back, the face through the back of the head. This epigraph, at least ostensibly, is taken from Bartholomew Rimbertinus on the Sensible Delights of Heaven. I have no idea whether that's true or made up. And this is the poem. An afterlife in the theatre. And this, gentlemen, removes top of skull, is the principal sulcus of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which manifests remarkable accord amongst the senses, even in the sane. The smelling salts for Mr. Bowman's sister. To speak aloud among the sober of the sweet reek of bright green, the soft hiss of yellow, the bitter shapes of the sound of the space in which we speak, their lavender numbers tasting of sesame, is indiscreet. Makes sense, but only one sense at a time. To remark on the silence breaking on the facets of a word, the way light breaks across an oil slick, to the polyphonic iridescence of simultaneous orgasm, betrays one to the panicked guest whose eyes alert the host across the room. Patience, children, learn to hush your wonder. Thus the Persian, weary of his wisdom, began his long descent into the world. Keep up, the argument has run ahead like an angry bearded black-robed bishop who leads us through a labyrinth of alleys to Chlorus, goldsmith, busy through the night in his workshop of important toys. Here a monk that kneels at clockwork prayer. Here a lady flautist trills and winks. And here his masterpiece, that nightingale of hammered gold and gold enamelling. It tilts its head, it whirs, it clicks its wings, and truly this is the devil's work. It speaks. Keep up, reach out, your day will come. Your fingers brush a face across the sea. At the commandment of the conjurer, he doeth take away the sight of any one. He is a great prince, taking the form of a thrush, except he be brought to a chalk triangle, and therein he teacheth divinely rhetoric, logic, pyromancy. He giveth men the understanding of all birds, of the lowing of bullocks and barking of dogs, and also of the sound and noise of waters. He ruleth now 30 legions of divels, who was of the celestial orders, and will possess again and rule the world. Keep up. The argument will run ahead, outstripping words, will tear down neural paths, branching, recombining, out of sight, and far beyond your power to direct. Upgraded man who sees in the dark, what you might tell us of the world beyond speech, no one, no, not even you, can say. It's an immensely chilling poem, I think. But it doesn't start out like that. It starts out with this idea of blessedness and being able to see magically see something from behind as if looking from in front, because one is blessed. Then it takes this sort of medical teaching theatre perspective. And I wonder in this poem, I'm not sure whether Mr. Bowman, who needs the smelling salts, is one of the students who is fainting as a result of this spectacle, or whether in fact Mr. Bowman is the man who's had the top of his head sawn off and is about to be given the smelling salts. It may depend on how we read this phrase, an afterlife in the theatre. Is this a corpse, or is this a corpse that's about to be revived with the smelling salts? But what you get in the second section of the poem is this, I think, amazing sense of the power of poetry to capture this move beyond the normal parameters of life that is hinted at also by Kevin Warwick's cyborg research. And here it's poetry writing about synesthesia, the experience of the confusion of the senses or the blending of the senses. And poetry, I think, what Donaghy shows here is how fantastically well poetry is equipped to do that. Partly because of the ways in which it can create associations and echoes between different forms of experience, different forms of words. The sweet reek of bright green. Those internal echoes associate the colour with the smell. Sweet also suggests possibly taste as well. But also, as you read the poem aloud, you feel the words in your mouth. You experience not only the sense of the sound of the poetry, but also a tactile sense, something approximating to a taste. So in that sense, poetry does achieve that kind of synesthesia already in the process of being spoken through. So from the beginning of this poem, you might have this sense that although there's this somewhat sinister moment with Mr. Bowman, that there's a possible alliance here of Kevin's cyborg work and poetry. And that's carried through too in number three, that you have this angry black-bearded bishop who might be wanting to expose the dangers of all of these things. What I'm reminded of in this section is Yeats's Byzantium poems, Byzantium and Sailing to Byzantium, and the figure in those poems of the bird that is crafted by the goldsmith. So poetry again seems to be working possibly with the cyborg project, but then suddenly this is exploded by, in a way, the figure of the black bishop exposing this as devilry and as dangerous. So poetry is implicated in that danger too. And the last section of the poem surely is a very frightening kind of stern warning. Will tear down neural paths, tear down in the way that you hair down a path, but also strip out the neural networks in some frightening way. And that final address to Kevin himself as upgraded man, I think, is very striking. And the emphasis on the limits of language. Remember, Judith Wright was talking in a way about the limits of language, to talk about something so small. Here the danger is that the poem ends at the point at which Kevin's researches take us beyond the reach of language. And even Kevin, can't say this. The most interesting part of, or the kind of interesting close to the story of this poem, is that in Kevin's response to it, he says, I see myself as I've never seen myself before by reading this, but I'm going to carry on regardless. Which I think is very striking. Turning then from one way of pushing beyond the parameters of life into the world of the post-human to another, which is into the world of death. And this is my one earlier poem. This is from a long, long, long poem, kind of 80-page odd poem, by Robinson Jeffers, who was a very popular American poet of the 1920s, he was extremely popular in these very long poems, long tragic poems he wrote, but very powerful, sold remarkably well until he squandered his credit with the American public by becoming all isolationist during the Second World War, which wasn't seen to be a very good thing. But this is from one of his earlier poems, Cawdor, and the narrative really doesn't matter for these purposes. But I need to tell you that what's happening here is that one of the characters, an old man called Old Marshall, is dying. And what this passage from the poem does is speculate on the nature of death within a purely material framework. So like Appleman, we've got no afterlives here, like in Appleman's poem. It's purely material. Well, I say we have no afterlife, but actually what this poem does, as you'll see as I read it, is generate a possibility of something equivalent to an afterlife within a purely materialist worldview. And the way Jeffers does this is by drawing an inference from brain science, and particularly from an idea of the dream as a product of, if you like, neural networks firing off, not necessarily at random, but certainly in an uncontrolled way, and creating, if you like, a simulacrum of consciousness. So when we dream, our brains, if you like, generate into being the dreaming perspective, our own perspective on the dream. And because the brain is what generates that, we perceive that as ourselves. It's our brain. And the associations are our own, and the memories are our own. Now, what Jeffers does in this passage is speculate that something similar may happen after death. Have a listen to this. Sleep and delirium are full of dreams. The locked-up coma had trailed its clue of dream across the crippled passages. Now death continued unbroken the delusions of the shadow before. If these had been relative to any movement outside, they'd have grown slower as the life ebbed and stagnated as it ceased. But the only measure of the dream's time was the dreamer, who, geared in the same change, could feel none. In his private dream, out of the pulses of breath and blood, as every dreamer is out of the hour-notched arch of the sky. The brain growing cold, the dream hung in suspense, and no one knew that it did. Gently, with delicate, mindless fingers, decomposition began to pick and caress the unstable chemistry of the cells of the brain. Oh, very gently, as the first weak breath of wind in a wood. The storm is still far, the leaves are stirred faintly to a gentle whispering. The nerve cells, by what would soon destroy them, were stirred to a gentle whispering. Or one might say the brain began to glow with its own light in the starless darkness under the dead bone sky. Like bits of rotting wood on the floor of the night forest, warm rains were soaked. You see them beside the path shine like vague eyes. So gently the dead man's brain, glowing by itself, made and enjoyed its dream. Out of time, undistracted by the nudging pulse beat, perfectly real to itself, being insulated from all touch of reality, the dream triumphed, building from past experience present paradise, more intense as the decay quickened, but ever more primitive as it proceeded, until the ecstasy soared through a flighty carnival of wines and women to the simple delight of eating flesh, and tended even higher to an unconditional delight. But then the interconnections between the groups of the brain failing, the dreamer and the dream split into multitude. Soon the altered cells became unfit to express any human or at all describable form of consciousness. What Jeffers does here is, in a sense, provide us with a consolatory afterlife, even within a materialist worldview. It strikes me how often he uses the word gentle, gently. This is something that is to reassure us. This is to make us accept our deaths. As a process, in a sense, even after death, it's a process. It's a process that sort of process of culmination, but in the process of culmination, also a loss of definition. And ultimately a splitting into multitude, which I think is almost unimaginable, but quite striking as an idea. And Jeffers' particular verse form, and this is his standard mode of writing, these very long lines within a kind of long, almost epic poem, works extremely well to do this, I think, because on the one hand, he folds in the vocabulary of science itself. We have words like decomposition, consciousness, cells, unstable chemistry. But on the other hand, he can create these kind of Homeric similes, where you have the decomposition of the brain likened to that extended simile of the wind through the wood, or of the piece of wood itself glowing. So here you have, I suppose the other thing to say about it is, here you have a poet who uses the tools of poetry to explore these possibilities, but he also uses the license that poetry gives him to speculate. And yet that speculation is itself a form of inference from what is known about brain chemistry, brain structures, or was known at the time. And well, the last time I read this to a bunch of biologists, several people said this is not far from what is understood now. So we've looked at death, and we've looked at the post-human. We've also looked, in a way, at a combination of poems that are alarming, possibly, but in some cases also consolatory. You can see the link from the Jeffers to the Appleman, particularly consolation, celebration. The poem I want to close on takes us to another higher level, and that's taking us beyond death to the question of extinction. And crucially, the question of ultimately our own extinction, but using the example of the passenger pigeon, which you will probably all know about. The passenger pigeon has been claimed by several authorities to have been probably the most numerous bird on the planet in 1800. There were literally billions of them. By 1900, they were all but extinct. In 1909, the last one died in a zoo in Cincinnati, I think that's right. Martha, she was called. It's virtually the only case where we know the exact moment of the extinction of a species, because, well, to within a quarter of an hour, between when the zookeeper last walked past when she was still alive and when he passed again and she wasn't. This is by Judith Wright again, and it's interestingly the poem, another poem from this same collection as Alive. And it's called Lament for Passenger Pigeons, and it begins with this epigraph from Wittgenstein: don't ask for the meaning, ask for the use, which is what Wright is going to challenge in the poem itself. The voice of water as it flows and falls, the noise air makes against earth's surfaces have changed, are changing to the tunes we choose. What wooed and echoed in the pigeon's voice? We have not heard the bird. How reinvent that passenger, its million wings and hues, when we have lost the bird, the thing itself, the sheen of life on flashing long migrations? Might human musics hold it, could we hear? Trapped in the fouling nests of time and space, we turn the music on, but it is man, and it is man who lends a deafening ear, and it is man we eat, and man we drink, and man who thickens round us like a stain. Ice at the polar axis smells of men. A word, a class, a formula, a use. That is the rhythm, the cycle we impose. The sirens sang us to the ends of sea and changed to us. Their voices were our own, jug jug to dirty ears in dirtied brine. Pigeons and angels sang us to the sky and turned to metal and a dirty need. The height of sky, the depth of sea, we are sick with a yellow stain, a fouling dye. Whatever being is, that formula, it dies as we pursue it past the word. We have not asked the meaning, but the use. What is the use of water when it dims? The use of air that whines in emptiness? The use of glass-eyed pigeons caged in glass? We listen to the sea, that old machine, to air that hoarsens on earth's surfaces and has no angel, no migrating cry. What is the being and the end of man? Blank surfaces reverb a human voice whose echo tells us that we choose to die, or else against the blank of everything, to reinvent that passenger, that bird, siren, and angel image we contain, essential in a constellating word, to sing of being, its escaping wing, to utter absence in a human chord, and recreate the meaning as we sing. What this poem does is take our extinction of the passenger pigeon as a symbol of human impact on the environment generally, and I think it's extraordinarily prescient for 1973, and particularly that line, ice at the polar axis smells of men, which is something that has been thoroughly corroborated, but long since Wright's poem was written. So it takes the extinction of the passenger pigeon as a symbol of our impact on the environment, but it also takes it as a forewarning of our own extinction. We choose to die if we pursue this line, if we pursue this exploitation and corruption of the world around us. And what she proposes in the poem is that the way to stop this, the way to get beyond this, is to think ourselves beyond it, to imagine ourselves beyond it, and that to do so is, in a sense, an act of poetry, an act of reimagining something, not purely to hold it and lament for it, but also as a kind of call to arms, to imagine the world in a different way, to rethink the possibilities, to sing of being. And, of course, song is another term for poetry. to utter absence in a human chord. So the idea here is that, in a sense, science has partly caused these problems, and a certain mechanistic worldview associated with science has. Science has also enabled us to discern these problems and discover these problems, but that science alone cannot correct these problems. It requires that act of imagination that poetry can typify and bring to bear to do so. So you see, in a way, that whether or not these poets are taking a positive impulse from biology, or a negative one, or often, I think, in many cases, both, I mean, all of them really, both, I think, they all suggest ways in which poetry can help us to imagine new ways of thinking of life that build on and develop and recreate something afresh from the basis provided by the science. Okay? Thank you.